Random House Audio presents Full Catastrophe Living, using the wisdom of your body and mind to face stress, pain, and illness. This is the author, Jon Kabat-Zinn. It is now 15 years since Full Catastrophe Living was published, and my hopes and intentions in writing it in the first place haven't changed in the intervening years. They have only grown stronger. Being about intimacy with the present moment, the practice of mindfulness is not bound by time. For this reason alone, its applicability to the human condition and to the rich potential of our minds and bodies for facing stress, pain, and illness with the deep wisdom that we are capable of as human beings is not likely to diminish with the passage of time. Nevertheless, harking back to 1990 when the book first appeared, the world has changed hugely, unthinkably, in the years since, perhaps more than it has ever changed before in such a brief interval. Just think of laptops, cell phones, the internet, the impact of the digital revolution on just about everything, and the speed up of the pace of life and our 24/7 lifestyles, to say nothing of the huge social, economic, and political changes that have occurred globally during this period. The speed at which things are changing nowadays is not likely to slow, and the stress of adjusting to it will only mount in the coming decades. My original objective in writing the book was that it might serve as an effective counterbalance to all the ways we get pulled out of ourselves and wind up losing sight of what is most important. We are apt to get so caught up in the urgency of everything we have to do, and so caught up in our heads and in what we think is important, that it is easy to fall into a state of chronic tension and anxiety that continually drives our lives on automatic pilot. This stress is only compounded when we are faced with a serious medical condition, with chronic pain, or a chronic disease. This audiobook is an invitation to the listener to embark on a journey of self-development, self-discovery, learning, and healing. It is based on 30 years of clinical experience with over 18,000 people who have begun this lifelong journey via their participation in an 8-week training program known as Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, or MBSR, at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center. MBSR, or the Stress Reduction Clinic, as it is often called, is a new kind of clinic in a new branch of medicine known as behavioral medicine, or integrative medicine, which believes that mental and emotional factors, the ways in which we think and behave, can have a significant effect, for better or for worse, on our physical health and on our capacity to recover from illness and injury. Many of our patients have found it beneficial to breathe in a particular way that involves relaxing the belly. This is known as diaphragmatic breathing. It may or may not be the way you're already breathing. If it isn't, as you become more aware of your breathing pattern by focusing on your belly, you may find yourself breathing more this way naturally because it is slower and deeper than chest breathing, which tends to be rapid and shallow. If you watch infants breathe, you will see that diaphragmatic breathing is the way we all start out when we're babies. In abdominal or diaphragmatic breathing, the idea is to relax your belly as much as you can. Then, as the breath comes in, the belly expands slightly on its own, in an outward direction as the diaphragm pushes down on the contents of the abdomen from above. If you are not accustomed to relaxing your belly, you may find your first attempts to breathe in this way to be frustrating and confusing. But if you persevere without forcing it, it will soon come naturally. At the beginning, you may find it helpful to lie down on your back or to stretch out in a recliner, close your eyes, and put one of your hands over your belly. Bring your attention to your hand and feel it move as the breath flows in and out. If your hand is rising during the inhalation and falling during the exhalation, then you have it. When we surveyed several hundred patients who had been out of the stress reduction program for a number of years and asked them what the single most important thing they got out of the program was, the majority said, quote, the breathing. I find this response amusing since every one of them was breathing long before they came for stress reduction training. Why would breathing, which they were doing before anyway, be so important and so valuable all of a sudden? The answer is that once you start meditating, breathing is no longer just breathing. The breath reminds us to tune into our body and to encounter the rest of our experience with mindfulness in this moment. When we are mindful of our breathing, it helps us to calm the body and the mind. Then we are able to be aware of our thoughts and feelings with a greater degree of calmness and with a more discerning eye. We are able to see things more clearly and with a larger perspective, all because we are a little more awake, a little more aware. And with this awareness comes a feeling of having more room to move, of having more options, of being free to choose effective and appropriate responses in stressful situations rather than losing our equilibrium and sense of self as a result of feeling overwhelmed, thrown off balance by our own knee-jerk reactions. All this comes from the simple practice of paying attention to your breathing when you dedicate yourself to practicing it regularly. Right in the simple old breath, I won't say right beneath our noses, lies a completely overlooked source of power to transform our lives. All we need to do is to make use of it to deepen our attentional skills and our patience. It is the very simplicity of the practice of mindfulness of breathing that gives it its power to disentangle us from the compulsive and habitual hold of the mind's many preoccupations. Yogis have known this for centuries. Breathing is the universal foundation for meditation practice. Of course, it hardly ever works out that way anyway, even on vacation. The challenge is to make calmness, inner balance, and clear seeing a part of everyday life, in the same way that it is possible to be mindful whenever we are walking, not just when we're practicing walking meditation. We can attempt to bring moment-to-moment attention to the tasks, experiences, and encounters of ordinary living, such as setting the table, eating, washing the dishes, doing the laundry, cleaning the house, taking out the garbage, working in the garden, mowing the lawn, brushing our teeth, shaving, taking a shower, or a bath, drying off with the towel, playing with the children, cleaning out the garage, taking the car in to be fixed or fixing it ourselves, riding a bike, taking the subway, getting on a bus, talking on the phone, hugging, kissing, touching, making love, taking care of people who depend on us, going to work, working, or just sitting on the front steps or in the backyard. If you can name something or even feel it, you can be mindful of it. Your formal mindfulness practice heightens your ability to encounter the whole of your life with moment-to-moment awareness. When you are practicing regularly, mindfulness will tend naturally to spill over into all the various contours of your daily life. You might find your mind altogether calmer and less reactive. As encountering each moment with awareness becomes more familiar to you, you will find that it is not only possible, but even enjoyable to be in the moment. Even with ordinary tasks such as washing the dishes, you come to see that you don't have to rush to get through the dishes so that you can get on to something better or more important, because at the moment that you're doing the dishes, that is your life. As we have seen, if you miss these moments because your mind is somewhere else, in an important way, you are shortchanging your very life. So try taking each pot and each cup and each plate as it comes, being aware of the movements of your body in holding and scrubbing and rinsing, the movements of the breath, and the movements of your mind. As long as you are doing it, doesn't it make sense to do it with your full being? If you choose to do things mindfully, then your doing will be coming out of non-doing. It will feel more meaningful and require less effort. If you are able to be present while doing routine daily activities, if you are willing to remember that those moments can be moments of calm and alert attention, as well as times of doing things that have to be done, you may find that not only do you enjoy the process more, but you are also more likely to have insights into yourself and your life while you're doing these routine activities. All the studies we have discussed and many others support the notion that our physical health is intimately connected with our patterns of thinking and feeling about ourselves, and also with the quality of our relationships with other people and the world. The evidence suggests that certain patterns of thinking and certain ways of relating to our feelings can predispose us to illness. Thoughts and beliefs that foster hopeless and helpless feelings, a sense of loss of control, hostility and cynicism toward others, a lack of commitment and enthusiasm about life's challenges, an inability to express feelings, and social isolation appear to be particularly toxic. On the other hand, other patterns of thinking, feeling, and relating appear to be associated with robustness and health. People who have a basically optimistic perspective, who have the ability to let go of a bad event, who can see that it is impermanent and that their situation will change, tend to be healthier than their pessimistic counterparts. Optimists know intuitively that there are always choices that can be made in life, that there is always the possibility of exercising some control. They also tend to be able to laugh at themselves, to have a positive sense of humor. Other health-related psychological traits include a strong sense of coherence, the conviction that life can be comprehensible, manageable, and meaningful. A spirit of engagement in life, taking on obstacles as challenges, and confidence in one's ability to make changes that one decides are important. Healthy social traits include valuing relationships, honoring them, and feeling a sense of goodness and basic trust in people. Since all the evidence we have looked at is only statistically valid, we cannot say that a particular belief or attitude causes disease, only that more people get sick or die prematurely if they have strong patterns of thinking that way, for whatever reasons. The relevance of the evidence presented here to us as individuals lies primarily in our ability to bring awareness to our own thoughts and feelings and their physical, psychological, and social consequences as we observe them. If we can observe in ourselves the toxicity of certain beliefs, thought patterns, and behaviors as they arise in the moment, then we can work to lessen their hold on us. Knowing something of the evidence, we might be motivated to look a little more closely at those moments when we find ourselves thinking pessimistically, or suppressing our feelings of anger, or thinking cynically about other people. We might bring mindfulness to the consequences of these very thoughts, feelings, and attitudes as they arise in us. For instance, you might observe how your body feels when you hold in your anger. What happens when you let it out? What are its effects on other people? On the other hand, you might also be mindful of positive thoughts and feelings as they occur. How does your body feel when you see obstacles as challenges? How does it feel when you're experiencing joy? When you are trusting others? When you are acting with empathy and compassion? If we can be aware in our own personal experience, as well as from the evidence from scientific studies, that certain attitudes and ways of seeing ourselves and others are health-enhancing, that trust and seeing the basic goodness in others and in ourselves has intrinsic healing power, as does seeing crises and even threats as challenges and opportunities, then we can work mindfully to consciously develop these qualities in ourselves from moment to moment and from day to day. They become new options for us to cultivate new ways of seeing and being in the world. People with chronic pain conditions who seek medical treatment thinking of their body as being pretty much like an automobile and that all the doctor needs to do is find out why they are in pain and then make it go away by cutting the right nerve or giving them some magic pills or injections are usually in for a rude awakening. Things are rarely that simple with chronic pain. In the new paradigm, pain is not just a body problem, it is a whole systems problem. Sensory impulses originating both at the surface of your body and internally are transmitted via nerve fibers to the brain, where these messages are registered and interpreted as pain. This has to happen before they are considered painful by the organism. But there are many well-known pathways within the brain and the central nervous system by which higher cognitive and emotional functions can modify the perception of pain. Studies we conducted over the years showed that there is a dramatic reduction in the average level of pain during the 8-week training period in MBSR, as measured by a pain questionnaire called the McGill-Melzack Pain Rating Index. This is a reproducible finding. We see it in every class year after year. In one study, 72% of the patients with chronic pain conditions achieved at least a 33% reduction on the pain rating index, while 61% of the pain patients achieved at least a 50% reduction. This means that the majority of people who came with pain experienced clinically significant reductions in their pain levels over the 8 weeks they were practicing the meditation at home and attending weekly classes at the hospital. Some people have difficulty understanding why we emphasize that they try to enter into their pain when they simply hate it and just want it to go away. Their feeling is, why shouldn't I ignore it or distract myself from it and grit my teeth and just endure it when it's too great? One reason is that there may be times when ignoring it or distracting yourself doesn't work. At such times, it's very helpful to have other tricks up your sleeve besides just trying to endure it or depending on drugs to ease it. Several laboratory experiments with acute pain have shown that tuning into sensations is a more effective way of reducing the level of pain experienced when the pain is intense and prolonged than is distracting yourself. So where do you begin? The body scan is by far the technique that works the best at the beginning for people with chronic pain, especially if sitting still or moving are difficult. You can do it lying on your back or in any other convenient outstretched position. Move slowly, scanning through your entire body. As you move through a problem region, perhaps one in which the sensations of discomfort and pain are quite intense, see if you can treat it like any other part of your body that you come to focus on. In other words, gently breathing into and out from that region, carefully observing the sensations, allowing yourself to feel them and open up to them, and letting your whole body relax and soften each time you breathe out. The people who embark on this journey in the stress reduction clinic do so in an effort to regain control of their health and to attain at least some peace of mind. They come referred by their doctors for a wide range of medical problems ranging from headaches, high blood pressure, and back pain to heart disease, cancer, and AIDS. They are young and old and in between. What they learn in the stress reduction clinic is the how of taking care of themselves, not as a replacement for their medical treatment, but as a vitally important complement to it. Over the years, numerous people have made inquiries about how they can learn what our patients learn in this 8-week course, which amounts to an intensive, self-directed training program in what you might call the art of conscious living. Full catastrophe living is a response to those inquiries. It's meant to be a practical guide for anyone, well or ill, who seeks to transcend his or her limitations and move toward greater levels of health and well-being. MBSR is based on rigorous and systematic training in mindfulness, a form of meditation originally developed in the Buddhist traditions of Asia. Simply put, mindfulness is moment-to-moment awareness. It is cultivated by purposefully paying attention to things we ordinarily never give a moment's thought to. It is a systematic approach to developing new kinds of control and wisdom in our lives, based on our inner capacities for relaxation, paying attention, awareness, and insight. MBSR is a vehicle for active learning, in which people can build on the strengths that they already have and come to do something for themselves to improve their own health and well-being. In this learning process, we assume from the start that as long as you are breathing, there is more right with you than wrong with you, no matter how ill or how hopeless you may feel. But if you hope to mobilize your inner capacities for growing and for healing and to take charge in your life on a new level, a certain kind of effort and energy on your part will be required. The way we put it is that it can be stressful to take the stress reduction program. The problem of stress does not admit to simple-minded solutions or quick fixes. At root, stress is a natural part of living from which there is no more escape than from the human condition itself. Yet some people try to avoid stress by walling themselves off from life experience. Others attempt to anesthetize themselves one way or another to escape it. Of course, it's only sensible to avoid undergoing unnecessary pain and hardship. Certainly, we all need to distance ourselves from our troubles now and again. But if escape and avoidance become our habitual ways of dealing with our problems, the problems just multiply. They don't magically go away. When it comes right down to it, facing our problems is usually the only way to get past them. There are two major ways of practicing mindfulness of breathing. One involves the formal discipline of making a specific time in which you stop all activity, assume a special posture, and dwell for some time in moment-to-moment awareness of the in-breath and the out-breath. The second way of practicing using the breath is to be mindful of it from time to time during the day, or even all day long, wherever you are and whatever you are doing. In this way, the thread of meditative awareness, including the physical relaxation, the emotional calm, and the insight that come with it, is woven into every aspect of your daily life. We call this informal meditation practice. It is at least as valuable as the formal practice, but it is easily neglected and loses much of its ability to stabilize the mind if it is not combined with a regular formal meditation practice. Mindfulness of breathing is central to all aspects of meditation practice. We will be using it when we practice the sitting meditation, the body scan, the yoga, and the walking meditation, which are all formal meditation practices. We will also be using it throughout the day as we practice developing a continuity of awareness in our daily lives. If you keep at it, the day will soon come when you will look upon your breathing as an old familiar friend and a powerful ally in the healing process. Now, to review, the very first exercise is to 1. Assume a comfortable posture lying on your back or sitting. If you are sitting, keep the spine straight and let your shoulders drop. 2. Close your eyes if it feels comfortable. 3. Bring your attention to your belly, feeling it rise or expand gently on the in-breath and fall or recede on the out-breath. 4. Keep the focus on your breathing, being with each in-breath for its full duration and with each out-breath for its full duration, as if you were riding the waves of your own breathing. 5. Every time you notice that your mind has wandered off the breath, notice what it was that took you away, and then gently bring your attention back to your belly and the feeling of the breath coming in and out. 6. If your mind wanders away from the breath 1,000 times, then your job is simply to bring it back to the breath every time, no matter what it becomes preoccupied with. 7. Practice this exercise for 15 minutes at a convenient time every day, whether you feel like it or not, for 1 week and see how it feels to incorporate a disciplined meditation practice into your life. Be aware of how it feels to spend some time each day just being with your breath without having to do anything. The second exercise is to 1. Tune into your breathing at different times during the day, feeling the belly go through 1 or 2 risings and fallings. 2. Become aware of your thoughts and feelings at these moments, just observing them without judging them or yourself. 3. At the same time, be aware of any changes in the way you are seeing things and feeling about yourself. For instance, in doing the dishes mindfully, you may come to see with great vividness the reality of impermanence. Here you are, doing the dishes, again. How many times have you done the dishes? How many more times will you do them in your life? What is this activity we call doing the dishes? Who is doing them? Why? By inquiring in this way, by looking deeply into this ordinary routine of, quote, doing the dishes, you may find that the whole world is represented in it, that you can learn a lot about yourself and the world by doing the dishes with your whole being, with alert interest and an inquiring mind. The dishes can teach you something important in this way. They become a mirror of your own mind. We're not talking about simply seeing that life is a stream of dirty dishes, after which you go back to doing the dishes mechanically. The point is to really do the dishes when you're doing them, to be awake and alive as you do them, mindful of the tendency to slip back into autopilot and start doing them unconsciously, perhaps also aware of your resistance to get to them, to procrastinate, to resent other people you want to help you but who don't. Mindfulness can also lead to decisions to make changes in your life based on your insights. Perhaps you might even get others to do their fair share of the dishes. Let's take cleaning the house as another example. If you have got to clean your house, why not clean it mindfully? So many people tell me that their houses are spotless, that they cannot live with mess, with disorder, that they are always cleaning and picking up and straightening and dusting. But how much of the time are they aware of their bodies as they are cleaning? And are they inquiring at all about their attachment to the house looking a certain way, about what they get out of doing it, or whether they resent doing it? Are they inquiring about why they are driven to clean compulsively, about who will clean their house after they are dead 20 years, or whether it will matter to them? By making cleaning the house into part of your meditation practice, this routine chore can become an entirely new experience. You may change how you clean the house because you've seen more deeply into your relationship to order and cleanliness, and into yourself and your own needs and priorities. Inquiry here means simply non-judgmental awareness, a penetrating behind the veil of unawareness that usually covers our activities, especially those that we do routinely. Perhaps these suggestions for how to do the dishes mindfully or to clean your house mindfully will give you some ideas for ways to do whatever you find yourself doing with greater awareness, and for ways to nurture a clearer seeing into your own mind and life situation. The important point to keep in mind is that each moment that you are alive is a moment that you can live fully, a moment not to be missed. When it comes right down to it, the challenge of mindfulness is to realize that this is it. Right now is my life. Imagine the following experiment, which was actually carried out by two prominent social psychologists, Dr. Judith Roden and Ellen Langer. They studied elderly residents in a nursing home. With the cooperation of the nursing home staff, Drs. Roden and Langer divided the participants in the study into two groups that were the same in terms of age, sex, severity of illness, and kinds of illnesses. Then one group of people was explicitly encouraged to make more decisions for themselves about life in the nursing home, such as where to receive visitors and when to see movies, while the other group was explicitly encouraged to let the staff help them with these kinds of decisions. As part of the study, each person was also given a plant for his or her room. People in the first group who were being encouraged to make more decisions for themselves were told something like, "This plant is to brighten up your room. It is your plant now, and whether it lives or dies is your responsibility. You decide when to water it, where it will do best." The people in the other group who were encouraged to let the staff make decisions for them were told something like, "This plant is to brighten up your room a little, but don't worry, you don't have to water it or take care of it, the housekeeper will do that for you." What Drs. Roden and Langer found was that by the end of a year and a half, a certain number of people in both groups had died, as would have been predicted for these nursing home residents. But the remarkable finding was that the two groups differed dramatically in how many people had died over the same period of time. It turned out that the people who were encouraged to let the staff help them with their decisions about visitors and other details of their lives, and who were told that the staff would take care of the plant they had been given, died at the same rate as was usually seen in that nursing home. But the people who were encouraged to make decisions for themselves and who were told that the plant was their responsibility died at about half the usual rate. Dr. Roden and Dr. Langer interpreted these findings to mean that enabling these nursing home residents to take more control in their lives, even over little decisions such as when to water the plant, protected them from an earlier death in some way. This interpretation is consistent with Dr. Kabasa's work on hardiness, which identified control as one important factor in resistance to illness. There is a complementary interpretation that I find myself drawn to, one that places the emphasis slightly differently. One might equally say that those people who were told that the plant was their responsibility to take care of were given an opportunity to feel needed in some small way. In fact, they may have come to feel that the plant depended on them for its well-being. This way of looking at the experiment emphasizes the connectedness between the person and the plant rather than the exercise of control. Even when making decisions about where to meet visitors and when to go to the movies, it is at least plausible that the encouragement to make decisions for themselves led to their feeling as if they were participating more, were connected more with the nursing home, belonged there more than the group that was not encouraged in this way. When you feel connected to something, that connection immediately gives you a purpose for living. When it comes time to let go of that region and move on, and you can decide when that moment is, let go of it completely. If it helps, try saying goodbye in your mind silently on an out-breath, and see if you can flow in that moment into calmness and stillness. And even if the pain doesn't change at all or becomes more intense, just move on to the next region and direct your full attention to it. If the painful sensations in a particular region do change in some way, see if you can note precisely what the qualities of that change are. Let them register fully in your awareness and keep going with the body scan. It is not helpful to expect pain to disappear, but you may find that it changes in intensity, getting momentarily stronger or weaker, or that the sensations change, say, from sharp to dull, or to tingling or burning or throbbing. It can also be helpful to be aware of any thoughts and emotional reactions that you may be having about either your pain, your body, the meditation, or anything else. Just keep up the watching and letting go, watching and letting go, breath by breath, moment by moment. As best you can manage it, anything you observe about your pain or about your thoughts and feelings is to be noted non-judgmentally as you maintain your focus in the body scan. In the stress reduction clinic, we do this every day for weeks. It can be boring, sometimes even exasperating, but that's okay. Boredom and exasperation can also be seen as thoughts and feelings and let go of. Also, do not be overly thrilled with success or overly depressed by lack of so-called progress as you go along. Every day will be different. In fact, every moment will be different. So don't jump to conclusions after one or two sessions. The work of growth and healing takes time. Mindfulness involves a determined effort to observe and open to your physical discomfort and your agitated emotions moment by moment. Remember, you are trying to find out about your pain, to learn from it, to know it better, not to stop it or get rid of it or escape from it. If you can assume this attitude and be calmly with your pain, looking at it in this way for even one breath or even half a breath, that is a step in the right direction. From there, you might be able to expand it and remain calm and open while facing the pain for maybe two or three breaths, or even longer. In the clinic, we like to use the expression putting out the welcome mat to describe how we work with pain during meditation. Since it's already present in a particular moment, we do what we can to be receptive and accepting of it. We try to relate to it in as neutral a way as possible, observing it non-judgmentally, feeling what it actually feels like in detail, riding the waves of the breath, the waves of sensation. We also ask ourselves the question, how bad is it right now, in this very moment? If you practice doing this, you will probably find that most of the time, even when you are feeling terrible, when you go right into the sensations and ask, in this moment, is it tolerable? Is it okay? The chances are you will find out that it is. The difficulty is that the next moment is coming, and the next, and you know they are all going to be filled with more pain. The solution? Try taking each moment as it comes. Try to be 100% in the present in one moment, then do the same for the next, right through the 45-minute practice period if necessary, or until the intensity subsides, at which point you can go back to the body scan. There is an art to facing difficulties in ways that lead to effective solutions and to inner peace and harmony. When we are able to mobilize our inner resources to face our problems artfully, we find we're usually able to orient ourselves in such a way that we can use the pressure of the problem itself to propel us through it, just as a sailor can position a sail to make the best use of the pressure of the wind to propel the boat. You can't sail straight into the wind, and if you only know how to sail with the wind at your back, you will only go where the wind blows you. But if you know how to use the wind's energy and are patient, you can sometimes get where you want to go. You can still be in control. The issue of control is central to coping with problems and with stress. There are many forces at work in the world that are totally beyond our control, and others that we sometimes think are beyond our control, but really aren't. To a great extent, our ability to influence our circumstances depends on how we see things. Our beliefs about ourselves and about our own capabilities, as well as how we see the world and the forces at play in it, all affect what we will find possible. How we see things affects how much energy we have for doing things and our choices about where to channel what energy we do have. For instance, at those times when you are feeling overwhelmed by the pressures in your life and you see your own efforts as ineffectual, in all likelihood, you will wind up feeling depressed and helpless. Nothing will seem controllable or even worth trying to control. On the other hand, at those times when you're seeing the world as threatening, but only potentially overwhelming, then feelings of insecurity rather than depression may predominate, causing you to worry incessantly about all the things you think threaten or might threaten your sense of control. These could be real or imagined, it hardly matters in terms of the stress you will feel and the effect it will have on your life. Feeling threatened can easily lead to feelings of anger and hostility, and from there to outright aggressive behavior, driven by deep instincts to protect your position and maintain your sense of things being under control. When things do feel, quote, under control, we might feel content for a moment, but when they go out of control again, or even seem to be getting out of control, our deepest insecurities can erupt. At such times, we might even act in ways that are self-destructive and hurtful to others, and we will feel anything but content. If you have a chronic illness or a disability that prevents you from doing what you used to be able to do, whole areas of control may go up in smoke. And if your condition causes you physical pain that has not responded well to medical treatment, the distress you might be feeling can be compounded by emotional turmoil caused by knowing that your condition seems to be beyond even your doctor's control. What is more, our worries about control are hardly limited to our major life problems. Some of our biggest stresses actually come from our reactions to the smallest, most insignificant events when they threaten our sense of control in one way or another. From the car breaking down just when you have someplace important to go, to your children not listening to you for the 10th time in as many minutes, to the lines being too long at the supermarket checkout or at the bank. In the first class, each person gets a chance to say why he or she has come to the stress reduction clinic and what he or she hopes to accomplish. Last week, Linda described feeling as if a large truck were always right on her heels, driving just faster than she can walk. It was an image people could relate to. The vividness of it sent a wave of acknowledging nods and smiles through the room. Don't we all tend to fill up our days with things that just have to be done and then run around desperately trying to do them all, while in the process not really enjoying much of the doing because we are too pressed for time, too rushed, too busy, too anxious? We can feel overwhelmed by our schedules, our responsibilities, and our roles at times, even when everything we are doing is important. Even when we have chosen to do all of them, we live immersed in a world of constant doing. Rarely are we in touch with who is doing the doing, or put otherwise, with the world of being. To get back in touch with being is not that difficult. We only need to remind ourselves to be mindful. Moments of mindfulness are moments of peace and stillness, even in the midst of activity. Meditation is really a non-doing. It is the only human endeavor I know that does not involve trying to get somewhere else, but rather emphasizes being where you already are. Much of the time we are so carried away by all the doing, the striving, the planning, the reacting, the busyness, that when we stop just to feel where we are, it can seem a little peculiar at first. That is not too surprising, given that we hardly ever stop and observe the mind directly to see what it is up to. We seldom look dispassionately at the reactions and habits of our own mind, at its fears and its desires. It takes a while to get comfortable with the richness of allowing yourself to just be with your own mind. It's a little like meeting an old friend for the first time in years. There may be some awkwardness at first, not knowing who this person is anymore, not knowing quite how to be with him or her. It may take some time to reestablish the bond, to refamiliarize yourselves with each other. But once you see the critical need to nourish your being, once you see the need to calm your heart and your mind, and to find an inner balance with which to face the storms of life, your commitment to make that time a priority and the requisite discipline to make it a reality develop naturally. Making time to meditate becomes easier. After all, if you discover for yourself that it really does nourish what is deepest in you, you will certainly find a way. If you are interested in establishing a formal mindfulness meditation practice yourself, and have tried the various techniques as we have discussed them, perhaps you are wondering what the best way to proceed might be at this time. Should you start with the sitting or the body scan? What about the yoga? How often should you practice, and at what times, and for how long? What about the walking meditation and practicing mindfulness in daily life? In the clinic, we begin practicing in the very first class. So if you feel inclined at this point to get started on a structured program, I will give you guidelines here for how to proceed over the next 8 weeks. The place to start, of course, is with your breathing. If you haven't done the 3-minute experiment on paying attention to your breathing and watching what your mind does, then you might want to do that now. We recommend that, at the very least, you do this every day for 5 or 10 minutes, either sitting or lying down, at a time that is convenient for you. The most important thing to remember is to practice every day. Even if you can only make 5 minutes to practice during your day, 5 minutes of mindfulness can be very restorative and healing. But as we have pointed out, we require the people in the stress reduction clinic to commit to between 45 minutes and an hour of practice every day, 6 days a week for at least 8 weeks, and we strongly recommend that you commit yourself to a similar schedule. For the formal practice, it's best if you use the Series 1 Guided Mindfulness Meditation Practice CDs, the same meditations that are used by the patients in the stress reduction clinic. For the first 2 weeks of your formal practice, we recommend that you do the body scan on CD number 1. Do it every day, whether you feel like it or not, for approximately 45 minutes. To cultivate mindfulness in your daily life, what we have been calling informal practice, you might try bringing moment-to-moment awareness to routine activities, such as waking up in the morning, brushing your teeth, showering, drying your body, getting dressed, eating, driving, taking out the garbage, shopping. The list is endless, but the point is simply to zero in on knowing what you are doing as you are actually doing it, and on what you are thinking and feeling from moment to moment as well. If this seems too overwhelming, just pick out one routine activity each week, such as taking a shower, and see if you can remember to just be fully there when you take your shower every time. And you might try to eat at least one meal a week mindfully as well. After practicing this way for 2 weeks, Start alternating the body scan one day with the mindful hatha yoga practices the next day, and keep this up during weeks 3 and 4. Remember only to do what you feel your body is capable of, and always to err on the side of being conservative, listening carefully to your body's messages as you practice. The mindful hatha yoga practices are on CDs 2 and 4. Remember also to check with your doctor or physical therapist if you have chronic pain or some kind of musculoskeletal problem or lung or heart disease. Continue to practice mindfulness of breathing in the sitting posture on your own, as you've been doing, without any guidance, now for 15 to 20 minutes per day. For informal practice in week 3, try to be aware of one pleasant event per day in your life as it is happening. Keep a calendar for the week, jotting down what the experience was, whether you were actually aware of it at the time it was happening, how your body felt at the time, what thoughts and feelings were present, and what it means to you at the time you write it down. There is now a great deal of evidence that early childhood experiences of isolation, cruelty, violence, and abuse can lead to severe emotional disabilities later in life. They strongly shape a person's view of the world as meaningful or meaningless, benevolent or uncaring, controllable or uncontrollable, and of the person as worthy or unworthy of love and esteem. While some children are true survivors and find ways of growing and healing from such experiences no matter what, countless others never recover from the early rupture of their connections with warmth and acceptance and love. They carry around scars that have never healed and that are seldom even understood or defined. Dr. Alice Miller, a Swiss psychiatrist, has made a fascinating study of this process in her book, For Your Own Good. Children of alcoholics, drug addicts, and young victims of physical or sexual abuse often suffer grievously in this way, but others who were less overtly abused may also carry deep emotional scars and wounds from childhood. For instance, a lack of closeness with your parents when you were a child can leave a deep wound, whether you are conscious of it or not. It is a healable wound, but it needs to be recognized as a wound, as a broken connection for deep psychological healing to occur. We see such wounds and the scarring they produce every day in the stress reduction clinic. Many people got messages from their parents or from school or from church or sometimes all three when they were children, that they were bad or stupid or ugly or unworthy or selfish. Of course, for the most part, adults, whether they be parents, teachers, or clergy, don't mean to give children such messages. To take a simple example, when a parent calls a child a, quote, bad boy or a bad girl, in all likelihood, what is really meant is that the parent does not like what the child is doing. But that is not what is actually being communicated. What is being communicated is that the child is bad. This message is all too easily internalized by the child. We carry around the scars of such treatment in the form of a lot of missed connections. We try to compensate in many ways in order to feel good deep in our hearts. But until the wounds are healed rather than covered over and denied, our efforts are not likely to result in wholeness or health. They are more likely to result in disease. In working with pain, there's another very important thing you can do as well as observing the bare sensations themselves. That is to be aware of any thoughts or feelings you're having about the sensations. Statements such as, "This is killing me. I can't stand it any longer. How long will this go on? My whole life is a mess. There's no hope for me. I'll never master this pain," may all move through your mind at one time or another. You may find such thoughts coming and going constantly. None of them are the pain itself. Can you be aware of this as you practice? It is a key realization. Not only are these thoughts not the pain itself, they're not you either, nor, in all likelihood, are they particularly true or accurate. They are just the understandable reactions of your own mind when it is not ready to accept the pain and wants things to be different from the way they are, in other words, pain-free. When you see and feel the sensations you are experiencing as sensations, pure and simple, you may see that these thoughts about the sensations are useless to you at that moment, and that they can actually make things worse than they need to be. Then, in letting go of them, you come to accept the sensations simply because they are already here anyway. Why not just accept them for now? However, you cannot reliably let go into accepting the sensations until you realize that it is your thinking that is labeling the sensations as bad. It is your thinking that doesn't want to accept them now or ever because it doesn't like them and just wants them to go away. But notice, now it is not you that won't accept the sensations, it's just your thinking. And you already know, because you've seen it for yourself firsthand, that your thoughts are not you. If you suffer from a chronic pain condition, there will be times when you will feel like quitting, especially if you don't see quick results in terms of pain reduction. But in doing this work, you must also remember that it involves patience and gentleness and loving kindness toward yourself and even toward your pain. It means working at your limits, but gently, not trying too hard, not exhausting yourself, not pushing too hard to break through. The breakthroughs will come by themselves in their own good time if you put in the energy in the spirit of self-discovery. Mindfulness does not bulldoze through resistance. You have to work gently at the edges, a little here and a little there, keeping your vision alive in your heart, particularly during the times of greatest pain and difficulty. It's not easy to find a word or a phrase that really captures the broad range of experiences in life that cause us distress and pain, and that promote in us an underlying sense of fear, insecurity, and loss of control. If we were to make a list, it would certainly include our own vulnerability and mortality. It might also include our collective capacity for cruelty and violence, as well as the colossal levels of ignorance and greed, delusion and deception that seem to drive us and the world much of the time. What could we possibly call the sum total of our vulnerabilities and inadequacies, our limitations and weaknesses as people? The illnesses and injuries and disabilities we may have to live with, the personal defeats and failures we have felt or fear in the future, the injustices and exploitations we suffer or fear, the losses of people we love, and of our own bodies sooner or later. It would have to be a metaphor that would not be maudlin, something that would also convey the understanding that it is not a disaster to be alive just because we feel fear and we suffer. It would have to convey the understanding that there is joy as well as suffering, hope as well as despair, calm as well as agitation, love as well as hatred, health as well as illness. In groping to describe that aspect of the human condition that the patients in the stress reduction clinic, and in fact most of us at one time or another, need to come to terms with and in some way transcend, I keep coming back to one line from the movie of Nikos Kazantzakis' novel, Zorba the Greek. Zorba's young companion turns to him at a certain point and inquires, "Zorba, have you ever been married?" To which Zorba replies, paraphrasing somewhat, "Am I not a man? Of course I've been married. Wife, house, kids, everything. The full catastrophe." It was not meant to be a lament, nor does it mean that being married or having children is a catastrophe. Zorba's response embodies a supreme appreciation for the richness of life and the inevitability of all its dilemmas, sorrows, tragedies, and ironies. His way is to dance in the gale of the full catastrophe, to celebrate life, to laugh with it and at himself, even in the face of personal failure and defeat. In doing so, he is never weighed down for long, never ultimately defeated either by the world or by his own considerable folly. Anybody who knows the book can imagine that living with Zorba must in itself have been quite the full catastrophe for his wife and children. As is often the case, the public hero that others admire can leave quite a trail of private hurt in his wake. Yet ever since I first heard it, I have felt that the phrase, the full catastrophe, captures something positive about the human spirit's ability to come to grips with what is most difficult in life, and to find within it room to grow in strength and wisdom. For me, facing the full catastrophe means finding and coming to terms with what is most human in ourselves. There is not one person on the planet who does not have his or her own version of the full catastrophe. Catastrophe here does not mean disaster. Rather, it means the poignant enormity of our life experience. It includes crises and disaster, but also all the little things that go wrong and that add up. The phrase reminds us that life is always in flux. In this audiobook, we will be learning and practicing the art of embracing the full catastrophe. We will be doing this so that rather than destroying us or robbing us of our power and our hope, the storms of life will strengthen us as they teach us about living, growing, and healing in a world of flux and change and sometimes great pain. We call the heart of the formal meditation practice sitting meditation, or simply sitting. As with breathing, sitting is not foreign to anyone, but mindful sitting is different from ordinary sitting in the same way that mindful breathing is different from ordinary breathing. The difference, of course, is your awareness. To practice sitting, we make a special time and place for non-doing. We consciously adopt an alert and relaxed body posture so that we can feel relatively comfortable without moving, and then we reside with calm acceptance in the present without trying to fill it with anything. You have already tried this in the various exercises in which you have watched your breathing. It helps a lot to adopt an erect and dignified posture with your head, neck, and back aligned vertically. This allows the breath to flow most easily. It is also the physical counterpart of the inner attitudes of self-reliance, self-acceptance, and alert attention that we are cultivating. We usually practice the sitting meditation either on a chair or on the floor. If you choose a chair, the ideal is to use one that has a straight back and that allows your feet to be flat on the floor. We often recommend that if possible, you sit away from the back of the chair so that your spine is self-supporting. But if you have to, leaning against the back of the chair is also fine. If you choose to sit on the floor, do so on a firm, thick cushion which raises your buttocks off the floor 3 to 6 inches. A pillow folded over once or twice does nicely, or you can purchase a meditation cushion, in Japanese called a zafu, specifically for sitting. There are a number of cross-legged sitting postures and kneeling postures that some people use when they sit on the floor. The one I use most is the so-called Burmese posture, which involves drawing one heel in close to the body and draping the other lower leg in front of it. Whether you choose the floor or a chair, the main points to keep in mind about your posture are to try to keep the back, neck, and head aligned in the vertical, to relax the shoulders, and to do something comfortable with your hands. Usually we place them on the knees, or we rest them in the lap with the fingers of the left hand above the fingers of the right, and the tips of the thumbs just touching each other. When we have assumed the posture we have selected, we bring our attention to our breathing. We feel it come in, we feel it go out. We dwell in the present moment by moment, breath by breath. It sounds simple, and it is. It is simple, but it is not easy. You can probably sit in front of a TV set or in a car on a trip for hours without giving it a thought. But when you try sitting in your house with nothing to watch but your breath, your body, and your mind, with nothing to entertain you and no place to go, the first thing you will probably notice is that at least part of you doesn't want to stay at this for very long. In week 4, do the same thing for one unpleasant or stressful event per day, again bringing awareness to it as it is happening. In weeks 5 and 6, we recommend that you stop doing the body scan for a while and replace it with longer sittings, up to 45 minutes at a time, and use CD number 3. Remember to let your breathing serve as the anchor for your attention in all of these practices. For the record, if your energy is continually going into patient self-observation from moment to moment, whether your attention is on the breathing or on other objects, and you're bringing it back each time it wanders without giving yourself a hard time, then you are doing it right. If you're looking for a special feeling to occur, whether it be relaxation or calmness or concentration or insight, then you're trying to get somewhere else other than